Ea mana, ea reo, ea tarangatanga maha. Tēnā koutou katoa. Fellow speakers. Thank you so much for being here tonight in our House of Representatives, right next door to the debating chamber where civil and uncivil discourse results in democracy or something like it. It is a precious thing that we have a night set aside to talk about the way we talk to each other, the way that we engage in public spaces. And I just wanted to acknowledge that you're all here to hear from faith communities, from tangata whenua, and that not so long ago, at least for me, we had our biggest act of terror, a hate crime in living memory against a faith community in Christchurch, New Zealand, and that I think shocked the status quo, and it shocked us all in terms of the scale of hurt and the lives lost, but it didn't necessarily shock the community targeted in terms of the prejudice that existed against them. And faith communities all know at some point in our history there's been persecution and there's been hurt. And I want to hold as well that it was tangata whenua who stood with the Muslim community to say that maybe this is a little bit us here in New Zealand, because the history existed of some kind of supremacy that had hurt them in our nation's history. I also want to hold and celebrate that we're here together in the midst of a pandemic, because our nation responded and shared information and shared public discourse in such a civil and loving way that we were able to respond together, do what we needed to protect us all. And I think that it was the language of, you know, team of 5 million. It was the idea of protecting the most vulnerable and listening to each other that meant that we could respond and we could listen to the science. And it's heartbreaking to see that others are kind of falling over elsewhere in the world, because that trust isn't there and the civility isn't there. And so information can't be shared in a safe way. So thank you for coming here. And thank you to our speakers. I'll do your introductions now, and then we'll go in the order that we discussed. We're going to do this in the order of the age of the book that each of them represent. And we will start with the perspective of tangata whenua. So we have Te Awa Pukatapu of Māori descent. She whakapapas to the local iwi here in Wellington, and she will be speaking about her experiences as a Māori woman growing up within her culture, speaking on the topic of underlying principles that exist to help guide conversations in public spaces according to Te Ao Māori. Then we will have Paul Morris, who is Emeritus. We don't use that term very often anymore. Professor in Religious Studies at Victoria University of Wellington, where he holds a UNESCO Chair in Interreligious Understanding and Relations in New Zealand and the Pacific. So his research interest is interreligious and intercultural understanding. His current research is on intersectionality and religion, and a study of religion, morality, and markets. As a trade spokesperson, I'm quite interested in that. Charles Waldegrave is a psychologist and Anglican priest. He coordinates the Family Centre's Social Policy Research Unit and works a day a week as a co-vicar at St Peter's Willis Street. Leads research projects that measure and address poverty, housing, and demographic ageing. And last but not least, from the newest of the Abrahamic books, David Bloxridge is a Muslim member of the Wellington Abrahamic Council. He avoids holding positions or office, but is keen on grassroots activism, flax roots, as the Greens would say. So we'll begin now, if you're ready.
Tēnā tātou, katoa. Te mihi, mea tuatahi, me mihi ki te whare nei, e tū nei, ki te papa e takoto nei, tēnā koutou, katoa. You can't hear me?
I can't
hear. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great. Is that loud enough for me to sing? Sure. Just before I start, I just wanted to acknowledge everyone here tonight and to thank David for inviting me to come and speak on this topic. I'm speaking from my own experiences as a Māori woman growing up here in New Zealand. I'm really looking forward to hearing the different versions and the different from the different faiths that we have here tonight. So thank you for having me. So the question that was put to me was, does it matter if public figures are rude and untruthful in interviews? And in answering this question, I wanted to work through some principles that are important for all of us to consider. When we think about public discourse, is that better? Sorry. But my initial response to this question is in fact another question. The question is this: why is it that so many adults and leaders don't know how to treat each other? When you can ask any 5-year-old and they will tell you. Many 5-year-olds can tell you both what not to do and what to do. For example, no put downs, or be kind to each other. Don't swear, or talk nicely with each other. Don't be mean, or use your manners. If you have nothing nice to say about someone, don't say it, or encourage people nicely. Don't lie, or tell the truth. These things are simple school rule setting 101 activities. It happened every year when I was at school, and I even remember being taught what good behaviour was when I attended Kohangareo. So for me, I've had 18 years of setting rules, of following rules, and receiving consequences because of the rules. And you know what? These rules apply to everyone in the class. There was no one who was exempt from those rules. There were no disclaimers or fine prints that said future politicians are exempt. Nothing. And often, teachers were identifying the future leaders based on their behaviours against these rules. And almost as if the rules were the indicators of good practice for leaders. Then we leave school, we go on to study, we go into the workforce, where we're expected to take everything that we have learned and apply them to make a positive difference for people in society. But we're here tonight, having this conversation, having this discussion about something so simple as human etiquette and behaviour. Why? Because people are breaking the school rules. The very simple foundations are often the very first things we forget about. And you can tell who's someone who's broken the rules because things like common sense, values, sensitivity, humility, empathy, and aroha often appear to be missing when they're talking. It's almost to the point where people will do anything in their power to win. An example of this is, a low-hanging fruit example is what we're seeing in America today. It's almost like there's this unhealthy mantra of win at all costs. And it's actively playing out, and the impacts of this are devastating. I want to go back to the word aroha. Aroha is to love, to care for, to be caring. It's a principle that I believe exists in every single person, every single culture, every single religion. To break that word down further, aro means to take notice of or to take heed of. Ha means your breath. And the message within those two words, take notice of your breath or the words that are coming out of yours and the mouths of others. And in the words of my 14-year-old son in answering this question, does it matter if public figures are rude and untruthful of interviews, his response was, "We're humans." So, I said I would sing. So for now, we're all going to take a little moment, and I'd like everyone to follow after me. Okay? You have to help me with this. Okay. So just repeat after me. Te aroha. Okay. Running in parallel to the life of school children is their personal home life. I was lucky to spend a lot of time in marae or meeting houses and have sat through many whai kōrero speeches from the pai pai. I want to focus this next part on the pai pai. And for those of you who are not familiar with the pai pai, this is often made up of men who are the speakers for either the marae or the guests. And if you've ever seen this process occur, you would be excused if you felt slightly intimidated or thought someone was angry because of what seemed to be yelling or angry men talking loudly on the pai pai. But for me, the pai pai was always a comforting place because I knew what was being said and the intention that sat behind the words and the actions. Marae, in my experiences, is the perfect place to practice what we talked about earlier, what I've just talked about, aro ki te ha. Marae around the country are often used for many different occasions, which range from small family meetings to big hapu or sub-tribe meetings about politics, about land, about the direction of the iwi, about birthdays, weddings, funerals, church services, all those common activities that can take place can be held on marae. And it's not uncommon to have a mixture of people at any of these events, from politicians, tribe leaders, community workers, whatever their professions. But when you're in a marae, you're Māori first. And your accountabilities and responsibilities to your people and to your tribe come first. And if you're a public figure in your professional life, this will be recognised, but it doesn't exempt you from displaying good behaviours. In fact, the pressure is often a lot higher because you're expected to represent yourself, your family and your tribe with dignity and well. You will constantly be reminded that you are and have parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, aunties, uncles, cousins, nephews, nieces, and children. And for Māori, we believe that everyone is born with mana. And we have to respect their mana. And mana can be different things. It can be integrity, prestige, but for me, mana means responsibility. And it's the responsibility that's been passed down to you from our own atua, from our gods, to be a good person, to treat people well, to take care of your land, take care of your family. Māori also believe that everything has mauri, a life force. So the words that come out of your mouth when you talk, or how you portray yourself to others, can be detrimental if you're not careful. For Māori, that saying, "sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt me," couldn't be any further from the truth. So based on my observations of being in a marae and keeping the ideas of aroha, mana and mauri at the fore, there seems to be some unwritten rules or law, L-O-R-E, that we follow in the marae, and everyone knows them. These seem to be, but not limited to, a marae is a safe place to talk about and resolve issues. Have hard conversations with good intent. Air your worries and concerns in a respectful and safe manner. Talk about the topic or the issue and not humiliate or target the person. Remember, these kids and elders in the room, always be cautious and be careful. And don't forget to break bread with everyone after the hui and clean up. This brings me to the second principle for the night, pono, or whakapono, belief in truth. In order to facilitate a successful discussion or debate on the marae, you must also practice pono. You must speak with truth, integrity, belief and conviction. You also must trust in the people in the room to understand your intentions and to understand the unspoken rules of healthy debate and discussion. So, next part of the song, Te Whakapono. Sing along with me, please. Te whakapono. Growing up as a child, I had to learn when it was appropriate for me to speak and when I needed to observe. Sometimes it's important to understand and practice silence, or what I call the art of being quiet. I often feel that the importance of silence and quiet is underestimated. However, it allows for people to have space for thought and creativity and to be considerate in thought. Silence and quiet also provides the space and time to practice the art of self-reflection, important for everyone, including anyone who has a platform to be heard. You see, those school rules I talked about earlier, whether we like it or not, are in us somewhere. If it's not the school rules, it's the values systems, whether it's from our families or from our churches or wherever they come from. They're part of our DNA. They exist in our minds, our bodies, and our souls. We just need to take the time to stop, feel, and listen. But if your pursuit is constantly chasing power and control, then you are only existing in the moment and not taking the time to be still. This is the art of rangimārie, being quiet, being silent when the time calls for it. Because it's only in these moments that you can find the time to reflect and remember. So, with me.
Me te rangi marie.
Me te rangi marie.
Now I come to us all that are here tonight, and all the people who are not here tonight. You see, we tend to operate in the here and now. We talk about the future, but very rarely do our actions serve for a long-term future beyond us or our own children. In our iwi strategic plans, it's not uncommon to see 100-year goals and beyond. That's how forward-thinking we are. It's a generational thing. We are here to pick up the kaupapa, the subject, the topic, the piece of work left behind us and to carry left for us and to carry it on, not to finish it, but to pass it on to the next generation in a good state. We're always thinking about our great-great-grandchildren and what type of world we want them to live in. For anyone who is in positions of power, including politicians, who have a public platform, you're an influencer. You are the public examples for our children now, who grow up to be our bosses and write our policies that will affect us and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren when we get older. You're also a voice for many, many people. So how you use that power and platform is critical to being able to live in a society that is free of division, free of racism, and free of poverty. If your platform is being used to divide and incite violence or greed, then I encourage you to take some time to think about aroha, whakapono, and rangimārie. If you find yourself saying, oh, but it's not my job, it's what I get paid for, it's the party line, I say bollocks. A politician's job and the job of people who have power and have a public platform is to be a good human. It's to be a good role model. It's to set the legacy of making a positive difference in the world for people. You're seen as leaders and being in positions of leadership. You are often referred to in Māori then as a rangatira, a boss or a leader. However, if we know where that word rangatira comes from, it comes from two words, raranga, to weave, and tira, the group of people. So you're the weaver of people. That's your responsibility. So I encourage all of us, think about our roles as leaders, not as a boss or a leader who needs to know or show it, but as a weaver of people. We're merely servants. If we look into the meaning of the word politician, we're servants. For me, it's really as simple as that. This is what our school rules have been trying to teach us this whole time. Or maybe I see the world a bit too simply. But complexity can be tiring, so I don't always do it. And just like it's our job to call out racism, it's also our job to call out bad behaviours with aroha, with good intention and honesty. But not to judge the person. This is a challenge to all of us that are here tonight.
And in the words of my 13-year-old daughter in answering this question, doesn't matter if public figures are rude and untruthful in interviews. Yes, it matters, because they represent many people. And to finish off, the importance of collegiality and togetherness, tātou tātou e. So, together with me, tātou tātou e. So together, we've just spoken the same language. We've sung the same song. We come from different ethnicities. We come from different faiths. And if we can do that tonight, then I'm sure we can do that tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. Nō reira, tēnā tātou, tēnā tātou, tēnā tātou.
Kia ora, shalom, alaikum salam, good evening. It's nice to be here. I've called this controversy for and not for the sake of heaven. I recently published a paper, Trump, Is He Good for the Jews? When researching it, I was shocked by his racism, his use of crude anti-Semitic tropes and conspiracy theories, unqualified encouragement of white supremacists, and his lack of respect and denial of personhood of people with heartfelt opinions that simply differed from his. As we say at the Passover, Dayenu, as if this wasn't enough. There were contradictions, denials, lies, deliberate distortions, denigrations, dehumanizations, demonizations, and defamations, and the seemingly endless generation of fake news. Fake news, just that's lying. I've written another piece currently in press on civility and debate in my own Jewish tradition as a kind of reflection, indirect reflection, on this incivility. And this address is shamelessly taken from the longer essay. So not all the bits link up quite as they might. To bring this all a little closer to home, we have our own character assassination, dirty politics. Our own crude and rude lies, ugly insinuations, leaks, denials, and a press that sometimes can foster and disseminate these. But before looking at the Jewish tradition, we need to ask, what's wrong with the rudeness and incivility, lies and deliberate falsification? In short, it threatens robust debates about real issues and polarizes opinions, thwarting consensus and principled compromise. It leaves only polarized opposition and reduces public discourse to ships passing in the night. Positive action on the issues facing us, COVID-19, pandemic debt levels, poverty, climate change, the fragility of the international order, all require broad cooperation and collaboration. And the incivilities of irretrievable dividedness deny informed debate on priorities and stymie concerted action, collective action, for the common good. Unbridled uncivil acrimony leads to the undoing of any functioning society. I want to begin tonight with the biblical prophet, Yeshayahu. For some of you, that's Isaiah. In chapter 1, Hashem, God, invites us. Lechuna v'nevkacha, yomar Hashem. In the RSV, and most of the English translation, this is rendered as, come, let us reason together. Making the invitation sound like it's addressed to a class of philosophers. The Hebrew root, yakach, in its nifal form, the form it is here, means to settle a matter, or to debate, or to reach an understanding. So I've translated as, come let's have a conversation, come let's debate together. Now, what I'm going to offer now isn't an ideal picture. It is a Jewish guide to taking sides, as we inevitably must. We find our life in our families, in our workplaces, in our communities, on one side or the other. And that's what I want to explore. Rabbinic debates, Jewish debates, took place within communities, often divided over the most fundamental issues. Tradition holds that empty divisions led to the loss of the Jerusalem temple and exile. Controversy has the gravest of consequences. The rabbis were committed to maintaining the cohesion and continuity of the community and developed frameworks for decision-making and dispute that allowed the community to continue with diversities of opinions and views. The rabbinic tradition of the sacrality of voices on both sides of an argument or dispute is valued for its essential role for doing two things. It maintains peace after a row, and it ensures the future of a single community. The long history of Jewish political life has been lived under the tutelage of other empires and powers. Jewish history is riddled with a litany of forced slaughter, exile, and conversion. With few exceptions of restricted autonomy and excluding degrees of communal self-governance, Jews have lived on sufferance, that is, at the whim and grace of others. Jewish survival has been that of a colonized minority, and Jews have had to rely on an acute awareness of difference, of compromise, of the urgency of addressing disputes, and of responding to exclusion and violence. This historical experience, shaped by mobility, migration, and mitigation, forced Jews to reflect on being a minority, of living among or alongside often hostile others, and of forging accommodations. Jews pride themselves on their ability to generate a multiplicity of positions and opinions, and their capability for deeply reasoned argument. You know, they say, two Jews, four opinions. Judaism can be characterized as a religion of controversy, argument, and debate. Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and the prophets argue with each other incessantly. They also argue incessantly with God. Debates and disputes, rather than pious conformist orthodoxy, have been the foundations of Jewish religious expression. Students are required not only to understand the arguments of the past, but to develop, a chiddush, a novel argument, in the present themselves. To study authoritative Jewish religious texts means following the arguments that are the framework for Jewish deliberations on practice and theology. For Jews, argument is a marker of success rather than being understood as a failure and something to be overcome. The commentaries, life is a life of commentaries, are really anthologies of arguments. They're structured as thematic debates. Jewish education is the mastery of these arguments, traced over centuries through texts and commentaries. Students enter and engage in conversations with the thinkers of the ages. Sacred texts are not opposed for Jews to human arguments, but are an integral dimension of them. The rabbinic understanding is that the tradition of argument uniquely and creatively generates unexpected positions, new solutions, novel responses, and has the capacity to do so generation after generation. Controversies are an integral part of Jewish community and Jewish continuity, as everyone in the Jewish community knows. And the controversies provide survival skills and tools for resourcing, fostering continuity across time. The debates themselves are considered sacred, as they too are Torah, a part of the authoritative normative traditions of Judaism. However, not all controversy, not all arguments are considered sacred. There are two forms of arguments, our tradition tells us, for and not for the sake of heaven. The Jewish tradition makes a fundamental distinction between two categories of argument. This is from the Mishnah. A controversy for the sake of heaven will have lasting value, but a controversy not for the sake of heaven will not last. What's an example of a controversy for the sake of heaven? The debates of Hillel and Shammai. What is an example of a controversy not for the sake of heaven? The rebellion of Korach and his followers. How are we to determine the demarcation between valid and invalid controversy? Hillel and Shammai are the names of two of the most venerable rabbis whose schools debated issues of law, practice, civics, and theology. The textual records of their debates form an element, core element, of Jewish literature. Although many of the more lenient decisions of Beth Hillel, the house or school of Hillel, were and are still for many Jews normative, the arguments and stricter conclusions of Beth Shammai are equally preserved for future scholars. And in the cases where votes were taken, the majority and minority reasoning and conclusions are likewise faithfully recorded. There are very specific forms and argument and accepted forms of evidence, and they shouldn't detain us here. But what merits noting is that these debates were not cold, logical exchange of proof texting. Rather, they were often acrimonious and heated, animated by passion, creativity, and energy, as the concerns of religious practice, business law, civil order, individual and communal life, and the relationships with those outside the community were addressed. Why were the controversies of these rabbis and these rabbinic schools deemed legitimate for the sake of heaven? The tradition considers their debates to be both valid and valuable, and that they brought authoritative experience and traditions to bear on contemporary controversies. And they did so in a civil way, even when extraordinary measures were necessary to reach a concluding decision. The engagement with the record of these debates and commentaries, including majority and minority opinions, is undertaken with the utmost seriousness. There's the examination of sources, their employment, and their steps on the way to definitive conclusions. The focus is always on the issue at hand in the context of the needs of the community. They're real issues debated that have real impacts on real communities. Both sides of the dispute were committed, in the words of the Mishnah, to the love of truth and peace. At the time, they are revisited by subsequent generations. Decisions form part of the repository of discussion for the guidance of those in the present and in the future. This is what I call Torah. Controversy for the sake of heaven was a vibrant, robust, and inclusive model of civil public dialogue, built on a common concern that recognized difference and yet still forged agreements that overcame separations and divisions within the community. The community has a self-understanding that spans across time, a history, a contemporary reality, and hopefully a vibrant future. For example, Rabbi Abba said in the name of Samuel, "For 3 years the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai have disagreed with each other. These said that the halakha, that's the Jewish law, was in accordance with us, and those said that the halakha was in accordance with us. And a heavenly voice emerged, the Bath Kol, and said, 'These and those are the words of the living God.'" So both sides form Torah. What then is an illegitimate controversy? The rebellion of Korach and his followers in the biblical book of Numbers records the paradigmatic case. Korach challenged the leadership of Moses and Aaron by accusing them of having raised themselves above the Lord's community. And Moses he accused of impropriety, unspecified. But as assertions and not as arguments for debate or discussion. The focus was on personality at the expense of the needs of the wider community. For the rabbis, Korach represents the dishonorable breakdown of civility in public discourse and politics. An enduring legitimate controversy is about humbly pursuing the resolution of a conflict without focusing on the deficiencies of the personalities of your opponents, or belittling them, dehumanizing them, or simply telling lies about them. nor is it about the acquisition of power for your own gain or profit, but rather it's for the furtherance of the collective good. Korach was focused on his own power, pushing his followers to reject all authority and law as illegitimate and unwarranted. Sounds awfully familiar at the moment, doesn't it? And he lied to them. The biblical narrative and the rebellion ended with, my translation, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them all up. Everyone who belonged to Korach and all their stuff that went with it. Debate and dialogue in the Jewish tradition are religious activities. There are rules of argument and behavior that clearly distinguish illegitimate argument from controversy for the sake of heaven. Legitimate controversy is not to be avoided, but is absolutely necessary in order to reach communal decisions. We need to take sides, and we need to debate. We need to have controversial issues. Controversy for the sake of heaven has legitimated over the centuries a Jewish politics of dissent in a creative and secure space for disagreements and disputes. So often we can't await the firm finding of common ground. If, in some cases, there is common ground to be sought in quite that way. And anyway, circumstances dynamically change. Politics is really about common ground. It's about being able to make decisions in the best interests of the community. For Jews, controversies for the sake of heaven are about these real political decisions. That of necessity must be made within perfect knowledge of the circumstances and the outcomes. It's essential for a community to be able to make decisions. And Jewish history is a history of having to make decisions quickly and often imperfectly. But it's just as important these decisions are accepted as binding on the parties that they deal with, they're concerned. And this acceptance reinforces rather than undermines the political decision-making process itself. Sometimes we have to make decisions and they have to be accepted, and both sides are part of that acceptance. This university is pragmatic, but it doesn't eradicate future dissent or difference. We have to live together with people we sometimes disagree with. Communities are by necessity sites of dispute, and these were generally embraced rather than attempted to eliminate them. We need our sites of dispute. Civility, at its most basic biblical terms, is simply the guarding of the tongue and the rejection of false witness. Truth and civility are not opposites, but necessary allies. We need to be mindful of the insincere call to civility when it's the voice of power simply attempting to silence opposition. You're uncivil, you're rude, I can't hear you. We Jews are not biblical prophets, but we are their heirs, speaking out against illegitimate exercises of power. And like Eliyahu Navi, like Elijah the prophet, we do so with the power of the Lord. He was often incredibly rude, but only when talking to those exercising illegitimate power. The Hillel quotation from the Mishnah cited above ends with, "If not now, when?" Being human is always being untimely. We must begin to alleviate suffering and pain now, even with the awareness this might only be, probably is, only temporary. Religious communities live and think perpetually in this interzone between the eternal and the actual, between fallen and yet saved, between heaven and earth. The world offers foretastes of the Garden of Eden, as the Talmud puts it, that serve as indicators of the promises of paradise. As we work to improve social and political systems to further equity and justice and ameliorate immediate needs, we experience just these foretastes of the garden. The messianic will always be premature and incomplete until the end of time. The premature perpetual is vital For without this untimely and barely tasted vision, all we have are endless power plays. They're all that's on offer. An eternity of ceaseless competition and consumption. All of our traditions have bulwarks against incivility. We do need perpetual messianic peace, but I suspect it's not coming anytime soon. Till then, let's come together and debate. Thank you.
Kira whakamui miti ki te atua, mō ngā manaakitanga me ngā āwhina ki a mātou. Nā rangatirama, tēnā koutou, mihi nui, mihi aroha ki a koutou, nō reira, tēnā koutou, kia ora koutou katoa. This discussion on public discourse is not really very straightforward at all, certainly not from a Christian perspective. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." But he also said, "You brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say any good thing?" That's about as insulting and as personal as you can get. And the way it's presented in the scriptures is almost like he said the same things on the same day. So it's quite difficult to make sense of this. "I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also." But listen to this. I've never insulted anyone as bad as this. "Woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombstones, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of bones of the dead and everything unclean." So it's quite a lot to work through, really, if you're thinking of public discourse, given that these things that he said were in public places. So a lot depends upon the culture, the context. What is an insult in some places is not experienced as an insult in other places. It's got these sort of contexts. But bombastic, bullying, scorning behaviour and lying is clearly not a good thing. I don't think anyone would want to support that sort of behaviour. But the angle I want to take on this is not so much about the obvious problems of lying and insults, but passive quietness in the face of injustice. A fear of conflict can be equally shameful and perhaps more shameful. It often takes courage to create peace. It's much more easy just to stand back and not turn on people as he did. So it's that I want to try and unpick. So let me give you a quote from Martin Luther King. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers." I don't know why the Muslims got off, but anyway, it was us two that he was aiming at. "First, I must confess that over the past years I've been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I've almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's greatest stumbling block in his stride towards freedom is not the white citizen councillor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice and prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice." So I think this notion of justice is sort of rather critical to this conversation about discourse, because quietness and gentleness when terrible things are going on is not a very moral position. It's a non-courageous position. So from a Christian perspective, our roots are very much actually in Judaism. And I think the way in which we come to it is from that history, because all the earliest Christians were Jews, in fact. And so, because the Old Testament is so much a part of what we use and such a gift from that faith to us, is that covenant is a really important theme in the whole of that body of literature. And the way in which the early Christians thought. And they had this term of, which they call righteousness, which sounds sort of weird to us. It sort of sounds like goody-goody two-shoes. You know, someone's righteous. It doesn't have a good ring to it. But it actually referred to right relationships. People who filled the requirements of good relationships with other people and with God. That was a fulfillment of the covenant. The covenant was about having right relationships. And it was essentially right relationships between king and people, judge and litigant, priest and worshipper, person with family, community with the poor, community with the visitor, and all with God. So each relationship had its own requirements and norms, and they varied with the different relationships. Right relationships were just ones, and they brought about peace. And all of these fulfilled the obligations of the covenant in which Israel was chosen and blessed. Now, in the Christian tradition, we inherited this, and all these people that began this faith came out of this sort of context. Isaiah put it really beautifully like this. Justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness abide in the fruit. Remember, righteousness about right relationships in these different dimensions of society, and righteousness abide in the fruitful field, and the effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness quietness and trust forever. My people will abide in a peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings and quiet resting places. So this was, I think, a really progressive way of thinking about society and the way relationships worked, and the balances that were there, and the respect that operated through all that. But it created a dilemma, because right relationships were just ones. So you see the seeds of justice in what was what was seen by the early members of the faith as a renewal of Judaism. They didn't see themselves as forming another religion. They were just trying to do some renewal as almost like a sect in the earliest times. And so if you take the Lord's Prayer, for example, most of it is taken from various other prayers and liturgies that were used in Judaism at the time. But there were two original pieces that haven't been found in other prayers. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our sin, for we forgive those who sin against us. And that's quite a clever piece, that last one. Forgive us our sin, as we forgive those who sin against us. In other words, in as much as we forgive, you forgive us. And so it sort of ties us up a bit, you know. I mean, that's the sort of clever part of it. But the give us our daily bread is quite critical also, because people in the ancient world lived in desperate lives. The economics of civilization were based on an surplus from agricultural products. Rulers and elites forcibly extracted that surplus from the peasantry and made them live subsistence lives. So about 90% of people were basically reduced to serfdom to support a small privileged class of aristocrats. And of course, in Israel at the time of Jesus, of course, it was a colonized country as well. So there were a lot of people around who were very hungry, sick, psychologically disturbed, traumatized, and suffered the effects of hard labor, poor sanitation, overcrowding, and particularly indebtedness. You know, you'd have a piece of land and then they just put the taxes up. You get the Roman tax and then you get the temple taxes and you get all the other taxes. And so people, you know, a lot of people were suffering. And so what you get in terms of this public discourse that I've tried to talk about, this dilemma, was he would go into a village and he'd immediately see people who were really suffering these things. The vast majority of people, in fact. And it wasn't just happening there, it was happening all over the known world. You know, it wasn't a Jewish thing, it was all over the place. And he saw those needs, he was immediately attracted to those people, and so he went, as many others were, and he supported them. And then he felt utterly constrained to address the injustice of the situation and expose the elites as hypocrites in a public way. And so what you'd get was this typical sort of going to the poor with a big heart, with acts of charity, healing, whatever. And then he couldn't help but sort of turn back to whoever the elites were in that situation, who he felt were controlling the situation. And that's when you got your brood of vipers and your whitewashed tombstones and those sorts of things, where he was wanting to expose and in front of these other people stand with them and say these things. So that suggests from our tradition, insults aren't always bad. Certainly lies don't help the situation. So he taught peace, but he knew he had to get his hands dirty to put his head above the parapet. He needed to make the comfortable feel distinctly uncomfortable because their extraction of that surplus was creating so much poverty and trouble for other people. So he politicized his presence in the village by challenging and even insulting the powerful people in a colonized theocratic state. He exposed the injustice and was driven by a righteous or right relations model of anger in his quest for change. Now, that wasn't new in Israel. That's what the prophets did. I mean, they could get very angry themselves, very justly angry, and it was sort of understood. So this is different from bad discourse, and there is bad discourse. And I want to give just two examples that really have made me shudder, two historic examples that really made me shudder. One overseas and one here. The first one's to do with Trump, but it's actually not during this present term. It's during the lead-up, during the election with Hillary Clinton. When he was able to say, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up, get the crowd saying, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. That is an example of the worst type of discourse you can possibly have. It was so unfair, it was so untruthful, and he used a crowd to get that, and she paid for it really dearly. It didn't work. The second one was in this country that's really stood out to me, and it was when Don Brash was going for Prime Minister, and it wasn't just him, it was his whole marketing team, and they started putting up these signs, Iwi or Kiwi. I think this was just appalling. Iwi or Kiwi. It was just what all that meant, you know, like, are you a Kiwi or are we going to do all this Maori stuff? I mean, it's just utterly appalling type of discourse that I think we have to look at. And what makes it different from the anger of the whitewashed tombstones is that it wasn't, it's not about justice at all. In fact, in both those situations, they're about injustice. Neither of them were about justice. These were well thought out, brazen, horrible tactics to misconstrue justice. And they worked in both cases. They worked for the people that used them. Brash nearly won that election. There was only one seat on it. Helen Clark was very lucky to get her third term, you know. It was very close. And you might remember he had that Orewa speech before that, which had built a lot of support through races. So, I think the issue is, what are the qualities behind it? And that, all the speakers have basically said that tonight. There can be robust discussion. People don't have to agree. There can be conflicts. And these are not bad things at all. And when they're just, then anger is the emotion of justice. And so it can be used. Of course, you've got to be careful with it. But I think if you look at the current situation, and I'd like to just finish on this, if you look at Biden now as the president-elect of the United States, he's looked pretty good because he's being measured by Trump or against Trump. But in actual fact, if he doesn't invest in the Rust Belt, if he doesn't invest in all those people who Trump was able to develop nostalgic stories and get all sorts of support, the people who lost all their jobs and so on in those in the Midwest and those middle and southern states, if he doesn't invest in those places and actually help those economies and get a greater sense of participation in the US society, then he can be as polite as he likes, but he's actually, his discourse is not worth anything. He's got to act on the words. It's not just about not doing these crude things that Trump does. It's actually about transforming the situation. So, polite and respectful language is good if it's addressing the real world. Public discourse, should be looking to the good. Public discourse is not an end in itself, or saying polite things and nice things is not an end in itself. Of course, it's a much better way, it's a much more pleasant way, we hear it easier, and so on. But it's not an end in itself, because politics carries power. There are nice people that do very little for marginalised people. And that isn't good discourse. It doesn't meet the high standards of public discourse. When we talk about public and when we talk about civil in relation to discourse, it should be about what's good for all people, not just a few elites, not just the people like us, but all people. And it needs to have notions of equity and fairness. It needs to relate to some forms of collectivity where we share. It needs to have the qualities of manu motuhake, of people being able to be self-determining, both as individuals and as groups, and self-determining as individuals. So it's those qualities and complexities that, that I wrestle with in the Christian tradition. Yeah. Thank you.
Good evening. Kia ora, shalom, assalamu alaikum. What do we understand by public discourse? The dictionary definition closest to what we're talking about today is formal discussion of a topic. Of course, discussion can range from friendly dialogue to heated debate. It's this last that's the problem. Heated debate has degenerated in recent years into outright slanging matches. The man who's one of the worst examples of this type of talk said during his recent re-election campaign, "I don't have to be nice anymore." Then he said the only way his opponents could win was if they rigged the election. And for good measure, he repeated a claim, and Charles has stolen a march on me here, that a former political opponent should be in jail. He lied throughout his election campaign, as also did his family members. Before we go any further, we probably need to ask ourselves, does this actually matter? Well, yes, it does, for these reasons. It undermines democracy and democratic institutions around the world. It casts doubt on legitimate elections and electoral procedures. It precludes compromise and fosters chaos. It deepens divisions in societies. It shuts out the voices of reason. It can incite people to violence. New vocabulary has entered the language to describe some of what's happening. Cancel culture, means withdrawing support for or cancelling public figures and companies after they've done or said something allegedly offensive. In America this year, this prompted a large group of respected writers, scholars and journalists to publish what they called a letter on justice and open debate. They wrote, "The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument and persuasion, not by trying to silence or wish them away. We need to preserve the possibility of good faith disagreement without dire professional consequences." Good faith disagreement is a key phrase there, and that's a theme we'll come back to. Another troubling phrase in recent years is Twitter wars. Research from the Oxford Internet Institute shows that tweets using extreme words, either positively or negatively, are more likely to be shared, which after all is the desired outcome for users of the platform. The phrase trash talk is not new, it's been around since the 1960s. But it has enjoyed fresh life in recent years as it has become normalised by some speakers. One definition of trash talk is disparaging or boastful talk intended to demoralise or intimidate opponents. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? But slipping standards of public debate is not confined to America. British author Ian Dale this year released a book, Why Can't We All Just Get Along?, aptly subtitled Shout Less, Listen More. Dale is concerned about the state of public discourse in Britain and elsewhere. His book examines why, in his opinion, we've all become so disrespectful and intolerant. He does make the point, though, that this is not a new problem. British politicians were saying awful things to each other a couple of hundred years ago. Still, it's become an issue today because of 24-hour news feeds, media demand for sound bites, social media, and deep divisions in society. Now, how should we be conducting ourselves? Here's the Islamic position. Muslim behaviour should always be informed by two sources. The first is the Quran, our holy book. The second is the example given by our Prophet Muhammad. His companions recorded his words and deeds, so Muslims even today would know how to conduct themselves. God acknowledges in the Quran that people are prone to argue. One verse actually says, "But man is, in most things, contentious." The number of times a word occurs in the Quran can indicate the importance of a topic. The word jidal, meaning dispute or dialogue, occurs 29 times. And the Quran makes subtle distinctions between simply needing to impart information and the need to argue a case more strongly. Verse 1 through 5 of chapter 16 says, "Invite mankind to the way of your Lord with wisdom and fair preaching, and argue with them in a way that is better." Fair and better are translations of the Arabic words hasana and asan, which have the same root but differ considerably in emphasis. Constructive dispute and debate is actually recommended in Islam. We believe it leads to success and cooperation. Islamic debating etiquette can be summarized like this. 1. Be sincere. 2. Lower your voice. 3. Avoid insults. 4. Know what you're talking about. 5. Use words people can understand. 6. Don't interrupt the speaker. 7. Don't lie, even in jest. Now let's unpack these. Number 1. Be sincere. Some people speak to show off the knowledge of a topic or to display their eloquence. Others hate anyone except themselves speaking in a gathering. Clearly this is insincere. The great 12th century scholar Al-Ghazali said, "Cooperation in seeking the truth is inherent to religion, but sincerity in the pursuit of it can be distinguished by certain conditions and signs. A diligent seeker of the truth may be compared to one who is looking for his lost camel. It would be immaterial for him if he or another person should be the one to find it. Likewise, a sincere truth seeker would perceive his partner as a helper rather than an adversary and would be grateful to him if he guided him to the truth." Okay, number 2, lower your voice. Or put another way, do not raise your voice. It's bad manners. A raised voice only provokes the other party. Shouting will not prove one's point. It can point to ignorance, whereas a calm voice usually indicates thoughtfulness. 3, avoid insults. One of our prophet's companions said that the prophet, quote, never used foul speech, nor did he like to listen to it. If a bad word was used in his presence, he turned his face away to show his objection to it. We must avoid debating techniques such as slander, ridicule, and mockery. 4, know what you're talking about. The Quran warns us against talking without knowledge, saying in chapter 24, verse 15, when you gossiped about the matter with your tongues and said such things with your mouths that you had no knowledge of, you thought that the matter was trivial, whereas it was grave in Allah's sight. The explanation accompanying this verse makes the point that slandering any person is a major sin. To slander someone is to lie about them. Sadly, some politicians around the world lie about their opponents, they lie about their achievements, and they lie about the world around them. The American politician referred to earlier has made more than 22,000 false or misleading statements in the past 1,300 days. They've been tracking him. You can go to the Washington Post and check it out. 5, use words people can understand. Our prophet said, quote, address people according to their understanding and knowledge. 6, don't interrupt the speaker. This should go without saying, but too often we hear interruptions in interviews and discussions. Al-Hassan, speaking to his son, advised, learn good listening just as you learn good speaking. Never interrupt a speaker, even if he speaks for long, until his speech comes to an end. 7, don't lie, even in jest. The prophet emphasized this, saying, woe to the one who talks to people and lies in order to make them laugh. Woe to him, woe to him. There is an interesting and important exception to this rule. The prophet said, he who has spoken untruthfully to strike a reconciliation between two persons has not lied. This idea of making peace between people was very important to the prophet. He said to Abu Darda, one of his companions, shall I not inform you of something more excellent in degree than fasting, charity, and prayer? It is putting things right between people, for undoubtedly discord between people is destructive. If we accept that a discussion or debate is an attempt to establish the truth of a situation, then certain things must be kept in mind. One is that we should adhere to scientific principles, presenting evidence to prove or support a claim we've made, and observing accuracy when referring to authority. This has been neatly expressed by Muslim scholars. If quoting, maintain accuracy, if claiming, provide proof. Imam Shafi, one of our greatest scholars, writing in the 8th century Common Era, said, I never debated with someone, but sincerely wished that we would arrive at the truth, regardless as to whether it is first discovered by him or me. Furthermore, we need to accept that we're not infallible. Another maxim common among Muslim scholars says, my viewpoint is right, but could be wrong, and my adversary's viewpoint is wrong, but could be right. Isn't that lovely? My viewpoint is right, but could be wrong, and my adversary's viewpoint is wrong, but could be right. A successful debate does not require either party to accept the other party's opinion. Should it happen that both parties agree on something, that would be excellent. But if they do not agree, the debate will still be successful, as long as each party realises that the other may stick to his views, and that these views should, therefore, be tolerated. Another 12th century scholar, Ibn Qudama, said, some scholars used to excuse anyone who disagreed with them in debatable matters, and did not insist that he should accept their views. Nowadays, we call that agreeing to disagree, or good faith disagreement. Unfortunately, it happens all too rarely. A debate would, however, be considered a failure if it resulted in discord, hostility, or accusations of ignorance. At this point, I'd like to offer a glimmer of hope from things I've heard recently. One's a BBC radio programme called Westminster Hour. It involves politicians and journalists discussing current affairs. With that mix, you'd think it would get heated, but the show prides itself on its good manners. I recently heard a British MP being chided by his peers for his lapse in etiquette, a rebuke he accepted with good grace. Now to New Zealand. Dr. Shane Ressie is the National Party's health spokesperson. He had an opportunity for some political point scoring at a press conference after Jacinda Ardern made masks mandatory on public transport. The government had been lukewarm about masks but quickly changed position. Most opposition MPs would have attacked the government, but Dr. Ressie simply explained that the WHO advice on masks had changed and the government was changing with it. His response was the best explanation of the government's new position, and it came from the opposition. Dr. Ressie, a GP by training, has said, "When I'm doing interviews, I say to myself, switch to doctor mode and do a consultation for the nation. Attack mode is not my style." Regarding the mask issue and his lack of criticism of the government, he said, "If our mission is to raise the collective bar and improve the health of everyone, how does that help? If I want to critique, I'd better have a solution as well. Anyone can critique, anyone can poke holes. That's the easy part. The hardest part is then saying yes, and this is the solution." Proving it wasn't a one-off, Dr. Ressie and Labour Health Minister Chris Hipkins went face-to-face on News Hub Nation on the 12th of September in a discussion that was a genuine exchange of ideas, both on points of common ground and disagreement. On one particular topic, Dr. Ressie even said, "We've already agreed to disagree on this." Isn't that beautiful? Chris Hipkins and Shane Ressie heard each other out without interruption in a very civil 16 minutes of exemplary public discourse. It can be done. As of today, Dr. Ressie wears another hat as deputy leader of the National Party. At a press conference this morning, he said, "I'm more akin to say less and do more." Significantly, he also said how proud he is of his Maori heritage. I'll end with this. If we can debate with sincerity, honesty, and an open mind without raising our voices, we won't go far wrong. Thank you.
Kia ora. I think we can all agree that there was a lot to take in, but I think I was at least surprised at how much we all kind of share common ground across religions that are often set against each other. As a Kurdish, Iranian, Sunni, Shia, Kiwi refugee member of the House of Representatives, I have a complicated relationship with both religion and indigeneity and public discourse. So I do really appreciate that we were able to come together in this hall and talk about that, about public discourse in a civil way, but also drawing from faith. I didn't introduce myself, so I will, just for a couple of minutes before I open the hall up to questions. I announced my candidacy for Parliament at about the same time as Donald Trump, and I know some of us are trying not to name him. But at the time that the Trump so-called Muslim ban was being introduced, and I'm from Iran, I'm from the so-called Muslim world, and I realised quickly that if elected I would become the first ever so-called refugee MP, and that this meant very different things to a lot of different people. And I got to hear about it. People sent me a lot of messages and posted comments all over social media with love. It really meant something to people under Trump, living under Brexit, with that xenophobia and mistruth that actually did start a lot under Brexit and then ran through the Trump election, against people like me. But they wanted to send love because they felt represented. It was the affected communities, and it was communities that disagreed with that type of discourse and leadership. But it was also this deluge of hate and fear and prejudice. And, you know, like I said before, those of us in those communities are not surprised that those sentiments exist, but sometimes we're surprised at the scale. So when I first stood up over there to deliver my maiden speech in Parliament, I felt a responsibility to those communities who, for the first ever time, were going to have their lived experience represented, to talk about the love and also the hate. And I wanted to say to the people sitting there sharing that debating chamber with me that some of it was caused by them. So I quoted some of the politics of hate and prejudice and scapegoating that there were members sitting there in that house had said, and I didn't name them, but they knew who they were. Because it's important, we can't shed our skin. We walk around out there in the streets and we feel that prejudice rise up, you know, as a hijabi woman walks her young kids to school, as Jewish communities go to cemeteries that they have to wipe clean from time to time as they're desecrated. And as Māori live in this land, and we stand on ground that was never ceded, we do feel it out there on the streets. It's not just words, and it never has been. And so, you know, my work here continued, and I began to do a lot of work on hate speech. And the other side of my life is my work, and my work has been through the criminal justice system and then through the international justice system, where I've worked on trials dealing with atrocities in Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, and in Cambodia. So I can say, having trawled through the thousands of pages of evidence, trying to pinpoint where a society begins to erupt with so much hate that it ends with atrocity, I can say that it begins with speech. It begins through dehumanization of a marginalized group, degradation, and it ends with the kind of violence that we refer to the UN for a war crimes trial. So we do have to learn our history, and we do have to understand that words do end in atrocity. But also I do want to hold that although we've come here together and we've done good tonight, that there are other voices missing. And we do have to notice that we experience the world through faith, but also through race and gender and sexual orientation and disability, and to continue to remember to pass the mic and share the platform and make space at the decision-making table, because that's the only way that our decisions will be lasting, will be strong and sustainable and useful, and it's the only way that we will break down the fear and the prejudice, and we'll face things like COVID, and we'll laugh at people like Trump together. So thank you. I'm going to open it up to questions now.